My dear god brother is Bhakti Tirtha Swami. Just, you might want to know, left his body a few days ago. 27th, yeah. So he was expecting a long time. He's been waiting for this. He was actually hoping much sooner because the condition was very bad, but he passed the final examination very nicely. A few weeks ago, he stopped all kinds of anything except hearing about Krishna, talking, you know, Krishna Katha, only Radhana Swami. Otherwise, only his caretakers, nurses would meet with him. And he had 24-hour kirtan outside his room. Sometimes he had them come in the room. Even on the last Ekadasi, he asked them to come in the room because he wanted to leave his body that day. But didn't happen. But so this was the 27th, that was Tuesday, right? A few days ago. So that's, I spent a lot of time with him, so it's kind of, you know, it's on my mind. And we're supposed to remember the great Vaishnavas. Many people are remembering, even people that only met him once, you know, how blissful he was. He started, when he got the word that he had the cancer, and then they operated, it wasn't healing at all. They wanted to cut off his foot, but he tried to save it, because with cancer they never can guarantee, you know, that it's not going to spread anyway. So, but that was a very miserable condition for him, because his wound wouldn't heal, and he had many, many other diabetes. All of a sudden, he just found out he had all these things. Some lung problems and diabetes and heart palpitations. And so he was trying to deal with it, you know, medically. But he was in very good consciousness, and he was praying all the time. He wrote it in a book called Die Before You Die. He wrote another book during that, thinking about it. I don't have a copy of that book, but it'll be available soon. Which is an important, I think Hayagriva Prabhu wrote a book also, but it never got published. He wrote by the same title, because he was also dying for a long time. So he, when I talked to him, he'd always say, you know, sometimes he would say how much suffering, but he would always say that he just hoped he could learn the lessons that Krishna was trying to teach him, you know, for all this. Of course, he had prayed to take away whatever's, you know, impediment for full surrender. He told me when I visited him in April, he said the two things that he was the most attached to was dancing and traveling. But all of a sudden, bam, they're gone. One doctor's appointment, and no more traveling, no more dancing. He was determined, you know, that after he cut off his leg, he was determined he had the artificial leg, and that he would, at his Vyas Puja that was in April or something, he did dance. They picked him up, and, you know, the devotees like this, and he danced all over. But he was getting weaker and weaker. He wrote, if you've seen on the internet, some very nice things for the devotees. He was very concerned about the movement, especially the youth. He was, many, many were writing to him. Many were inspired by him. And especially as he was leaving his body, they became more inspired, because, you know, when you're going to lose something and you feel more attached. So he had taken a great interest in the welfare of the devotees. You know, psychologically, because he studied psychology in college, and when he went to the university, Princeton, and he, before he became a devotee, he was running some drug rehabilitation centers. He was in that, you know, had that talent. And when he traveled, especially when he traveled in Eastern Europe and Russia, then he saw how many devotees were distressed and suffering from depression and all kinds of things. So he took up, you know, writing a lot of books and trying to help devotees in a very compassionate way. He was very caring, so I hope we can learn to take his example. Traveled extensively, worked very hard. I met him first in Chicago when I was distributing books, and he was traveling with the library party, going around in America at that time, giving sets of Bhagavatam to the colleges and the libraries and professors. So they came to somehow visit us on book distribution, and I remember he was following me around, he was taking notes, you know, he was listening so intensely to everything I said, so naturally I became very puffed up, but noted that he was very, you know, humble like that, very, you know, anxious to learn more and more. Then I got together with him later when we were had a party in America trying to sell sets of Srimad Bhagavatam. So we were partners for some time. And they had started before I joined that party. They didn't really know how to, you know, who to approach. So they got the list of subscribers to one of these magazines for mystical, you know, stuff. And then they would call them up and say, we have these mystical books, ancient books from India, and would you like to have a look at them? So many people would say yes. And we'd go to their houses, and these people, like, there were some far-out people. Some of them had, like, so many, every kind of far-out weird book you could ever think of they had, you know, from all over the universe. And but we were selling books. He had a very interesting way. He would tell people that I read auras, he said, and I guess he did do that before. And he would tell them, anyway, you have this spiritual aura, and I can see that in your past life you were a big yogi, but you made some offense, and he fell down. So he was preaching, you know, and without talking about Krishna very much, but people would become very charmed, and we were selling quite a few sets. Unfortunately, that party, after the disappearance of Prabhupada, everything got disrupted, and everybody ended up, you know, in different places. But we had some adventures. At that time, he was very averse to sleeping, and he would, whenever he woke up in the night, he would get up. And he wouldn't go back to sleep, so he didn't like to ever sit down. He was always jumping up and down, chanting japa for fear of falling asleep. Unfortunately, he also fell asleep driving the car a lot, but he had one accident, and I told him maybe he shouldn't drive anymore, and he appreciated that. Later, we got together because I went to Africa. He'd been mostly in Africa for quite a few years, and he was preaching in Washington, D.C. They had a very dynamic preaching there. He concentrated on the Afro-Americans, which they weren't getting that much attention from other devotees. The specialized field, one girl, she said that the black people are paranoid and the white people are racist, so it's very hard to bring them together, you know, and especially in the beginning time. So he would concentrate on them, and he had several TV programs, and there was one university there, and he would do regular programs at that university, and he would advertise, you know, specific mystical topics, the pyramids and, you know, UFOs and different things, and that would attract people very much. And he would speak very authoritatively. He would actually, I remember I called him one time, and they said he's at the library, you know, studying about pyramids. So he could speak authoritatively. He didn't just say any old thing, you know. He would, but he didn't present it like this as absolute Vedic authority, but he would charm the people very much. And he would weave in all kinds of philosophy also. Especially, I listened to a couple of them, this theme about falling down because of making offenses. He would always talk about that. But it would put it into other perspectives, not just like bhakti yoga. But many people became interested, and they would get the tapes, and then they would catch them and bring them to the temple, to their center, and he made many devotees. At that time, in America, nobody was making devotees, but he was making a lot of devotees, and they were all educated. At least they were graduates. Many were master's degrees. They were, like one couple, they were counselors at the prison, and they were executives, all kinds of different skills. He had a martial arts studio called the Nisringa Martial Arts Studio. One devotee was a policeman, actually, but he had a black belt in everything. You know, every kind of martial art, he was top. He was just really good at it. And they would make devotees from that also. They would, pick out the people that had some inclination, get him reading Bhagavad Gita and make him devotees. So he made a lot of devotees. But he was staying aloof from the society for various reasons. At that time, after Prabhupada's disappearance, and then there was a lot of turmoil. We don't need to go over the history, but he was kind of in the middle of some of it. And so there were, naturally rumors, oh, he's doing this, he's doing that. But I went to visit him and I saw very nice, so many devotees, very far out programs going on. And in Africa also, there were many devotees. Africa is crazy, but he spent a lot of time there, 7 months a year. At that time it was not easy to be in Africa. Communication, like postage, you had a 50% chance maybe of a letter getting either direction. He tried everything, because the Africans are really like very babies. They fight really easy. They become happy really easy. They get upset really easy. They think so. He would answer so many letters, but only half of them would get there. And then the other ones, why don't you write? You don't like me. You didn't write to me. He tried everything. He would send a packet with all the letters in one packet, but then that would all get lost. No telephones. Even I didn't go there till like 80, when did I go there? 90 something. And even then, like when we wanted to use the telephone, we'd have to find, even in a city, one, government telephone place. But even half the time that would, you'd get there, but it wouldn't work. It'd be out of order. You go to some Indian house, but the electricity had been off for a week, and the phone wouldn't work anymore, and the phone lines. And the Indians told me they have to keep their phone turned off because, otherwise the neighbor might use it. The lines would cross. Even accidentally they would cross. But on purpose people just tap in. And really crazy. And traveling was really difficult. But he became very famous there. He was quite well known. Got on the people were, at that time there was a lot of money in Nigeria. The economy was good. And he had a lot of television shows. That in Africa, the television people are very interested in religion, and Hare Krishna was new, and he was, there many television shows, many, many different things. So he made a lot of devotees. They got a lot of things donated, a lot of property. But then, I actually was instrumental. I convinced him to come to Mayapur for the GVC meetings. That was in the centennial year. So I requested that they don't involve him in all the politics and all the madness, and just put him on the committees. So they put him on the World Harinam Day or the World, a couple different days. And he got really into it, and the devotees really liked him, he was really enlivened all the time. So he became so popular that he hardly had time to go back to Africa, so he stuck me with most of Africa. He said, you can have it. But still the devotees are attached to him, so whenever there was anything come up, they always went to him. But he traveled extensively all over Eastern Europe and Russia especially, but everywhere, Australia, giving seminars on all kinds of things. like depression and dealing with depression in Krishna consciousness. It sounds contradictory, but many devotees are carrying with them many baggages from previous time, and they impose that on the Krishna conscious society and have a hard time. Or they have to deal with, you know, mother that's depressed that calls them all the time or something. So he helped a lot of devotees in that way. He had a tremendous amount of email coming in all the time. He never touched a computer. He always had someone else type it out and read it to him. He stayed aloof from that. Even when he was writing, he wrote by hand. And he would just have the devotees transcribe all his lectures. He, somehow Krishna provided him with a lot of help, a lot of competent people. So what he made in Washington, D.C. was called the IFAST, IFAST, the Institute for Advanced Spiritual Technology. But he would, you know, he would give these lectures and he would say, so I'm going to introduce a lot of technology for making spiritual advancement. Then when he would get to that, he would say that technology was chanting, you know, these mantras and stuff. He was very, very clever the way he presented everything he could. And then he got in a lot of conferences with professional people, also doctors. He was expert at meeting. He had, because he went to Princeton University, that's, I don't know how they rate universities, you know, but that's considered in the top five or something of America. There's Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford is in there somewhere. Huh? Those are the main ones. The way he got, he was actually, grew up in the very poor ghetto of Cleveland, Ohio. I asked him how he got into that, you know, university, because there were many different stories. He went to the prep school. Prep school is, they have that here. You know, it's for the rich kids that they're supposed to end up going to Harvard and Yale and all those preparatory schools, usually only boys. Devamrita Swami went to one also. But Devamrita Swami is from a rich family, but Bhakti Chaturmaraj's father left, abandoned the family, and got rich, but never gave the kids or the wife anything. But after he graduated high school in the ghetto, then he was tutoring kids. And somebody saw him, somebody from some welfare group, and they liked him, so they offered him to go to this prep school. So he again did the senior year of high school in the prep school. And then they said, you can go to any university you want. We'll send you there. They gave him everything. The tuition and money to live there, the whole thing. It's big money in those schools. So he somehow, I don't know why he chose Princeton. He went there. In those days, one of the reasons was that was in the civil rights time. That was around 68, 69. The civil rights, that black people just gotten privileges, you know, they were starting to integrate the schools. It was a big, big thing in America. Lots of riots, and Martin Luther King was killed, and all kinds of things. So these universities wanted to have some minority people so they could show that they were open-minded. But he said there was a lot of prejudice, a lot of, you know, a lot of harassment, but he did very well there. He was popular. Graduated. And somehow he got together with the devotees. He tells many long stories about that. He had a yoga teacher. And devotees that were his bhakta leader said he was just a really humble, simple guy when he was in the bhakta, but then he got in that library party and he just really came to life. And he was especially noted by Prabhupada because he went to communist countries. I just read here he went with Gurudas. Gurudas went with him. They went to a bunch of communist countries. They sold a few books, only like one, because they couldn't carry the books in or to hide them to professors. Prabhupada was so happy when he came to Vrindavan. The end of Prabhupada's life, Prabhupada was holding his head and petting him on the head and thanking him so much for going to these communist countries. Then he, after Prabhupada's disappearance, we did that library party for a little while, but it fell apart. I noted that he studied Prabhupada's books like really intensely. And he would always like to talk about, you know, all kinds of things from Prabhupada's book in a very nice way. That's all I remember when we traveled together in that party, is that we just discussed Prabhupada's books. So that I was a little bit more inclined in those days also. I was only a book distributor, so I only read the books and sold them. I didn't do anything else. I thought that I would never do anything else, but Krishna smashed me to show that I had some all kinds of desires to do other things. So anyway, after all this, and he ended up going to Africa, and I talked about that, and then he established so many things in America. Then he was on the GBC, got a lot of assignments, Detroit, and Gitanagari, especially Washington, D.C., and he was a great help in all those places. They were having a lot of trouble. He took that Gitanagari very seriously, and in the beginning he tried really hard to establish the, you know, the Varnashram thing Prabhupada wanted. I was just in the Nisringa Chaitra, so thinking about it. If you remember that at Prabhupada, when he went to London at the end of his life, he was talking, I'm going to go to Gitanagari and establish Varnashram. So I just read, devotees were asking him, like, you know, what is Varnashram? What do you mean? A lot of discussion about that, right? So many theories. He said, I will sit down at Gitanagari and I will teach them to live off the land. So they wanted to do that, but it didn't work out yet. He brought his best people there. He shut down the center in Washington, D.C., actually, to move everybody up there. And they kept it going, you know, got the new temple built, take care of the deities. But like everywhere, no, Westerners don't particularly want to be farmers. Didn't happen yet. But he chose to stay there to leave his body. It wasn't that he couldn't have moved when he knew that time was going to run out. He talked about going to Mayapur, talked about this and that, but he decided to stay there because he wanted to stress the importance of that project and try to inspire devotees to take it up, and it is a holy place. And so it was quite amazing. So many devotees, his disciples, God brothers, they were going there to visit. I went there. I made a mystical visit there because I was in Africa. And I was thinking, I'm not going to get to America. Maybe he's going to leave his body, and I better make a special trip. So I was, you know, I was thinking, you know, where am I going to pay for this? And so one devotee there, he's a travel agent. So I just asked him to check the prices. Then he came back with different prices, and you know, the devotee said, he wants right away, he got to have, he wants to make the reservation. I said, wait a minute, you know, he didn't tell me anything. I said, does he want me to buy the ticket or what? He said, yeah, I think so. But he came and he was saying, I can get you a ticket on British Airways, open, return, open this, stop in London. I said, oh, great, you know. And he gave me the ticket, business class. So I thought, wow, this is... And Bhakti Chaitanya said, you must be for Africa because no one ever gave him a ticket. No one ever gave me, well, last time somebody did give me almost enough to cover the flight. But previously, you know, they just asked for money. GBC means you bring money. You know, guru means you bring money. That's how it was in the but anyway, he gave the ticket, and so I went there and spent some time with him. When I saw him, he was smiling so big, and he looked very happy and didn't look like anything was wrong. But as you see, look at the body, then you see. But he was preaching very, very strongly, and he was going every Sunday to the temple, which wasn't easy. It was quite a long car ride and very bad roads. The farm road, very bad on our private road for at least a mile. But he... went to the temple, gave a strong class, came back, and the next week, 2 weeks the next weekend after I left, so we had a big festival in New Vrindavan, and so many devotees were there, and they showed the video of his previous week's Sunday lecture, and immediately 100 devotees left New Vrindavan before the festival was over and went to Gitanagari to see this Sunday's lecture. And then when he asked Radhanath to please stay, he said, "I'm going to leave my body pretty soon and need association, and the devotees need association." So he stayed. I talked to him. He said, "Yeah, I changed. I lost my whole schedule," he said. But he was just saying, "He's so humble. He's so wonderful, Vaishnava. He's just so nice. He was glorifying Bhakti Tipsa." He took, he revealed it, because he was very aggressive and preached very strongly. Sometimes he was really heavy when he thought that we were doing something wrong. Even the whole movement, he would stand up in the GBC really heavy. But he dropped everything. He just completely peaceful, just want to hear Krishna, Katha, and so happy to be around devotees. So many, many devotees came and visited that time. Many sannyasis were there. And at the end, many more came because they knew in the last few days the time was coming. So there was a big crowd of devotees there, a big, big kirtan, and he was very, very happy. So now we have the memory. This is, I guess, the normal day. You have the feast 3 days later. And you should have a picture. At Munich and at the farm, they had his picture on the desk. But this is a time to try to remember, because we want to remember great devotees. We find the scripture doesn't... There's one book by Narahari Sakar, his famous associate of Lord Chaitanya, and he wrote about many things. So at one point, they're usually glorifying so many devotees and all the wonderful devotees. And he mentioned one devotee who deviated. But he said, "I will not write down, what his deviation was or what he did, because we don't want to preserve it." That's why you don't find in the scriptures of great devotees any detailed descriptions of all the deviants. There's always deviants, there's always trouble. But we want to concentrate on the good ones so that we can aim our, selves in that direction. Whatever you meditate on, that's what you're going to become. So we want to think about the good devotees, and there's so many. And also all of us, nobody's guaranteed to stay in their body. Nobody knows when it's going to happen. Sometimes it comes very suddenly as a big surprise to everybody. Sometimes someone we know, we're waiting. But Krishna consciousness is full of surprises. I've just been reading this book by Gurudas, Remembering Prabhupada. So he was very close to Prabhupada from the very beginning days. And the first time Prabhupada called, they did Harinam on Gaur Purnima. He decided, "Let's go out and chant." So they were chanting, they got under Prabhupada's room. And Prabhupada looked out the window and he went like this. So they thought, "He doesn't like it, they should go away." So they went back to the temple, but the servant came running out and said, "Prabhupada, when you do this in India, that means come." Right? In India, they go like this, and you always think they're saying, "Get out of here." But it means come, They go like this. So Prabhupada called him up and he said, "Now you've understood Lord Chaitanya. You're chanting in the streets like him, so now you can do that every day." So that's how Harinam got started in San Francisco. And then Prabhupada called him one time and to the room, and he'd never been called like that privately. And he was expecting some kind of really deep, Krishna conscious katha and everything. And Prabhupada asked him, "Is Pentax a good brand of camera?" He said, "Yes, that's a good brand." And Prabhupada said, "What kind do you use?" And he told him, "I use a Nikon." And then Prabhupada said, "One friend has asked me to bring him a Pentax from India." So he asked him about cameras, and he showed him the light meter and, how you put your finger and the needle goes away. And Prabhupada played with it for a long time. Then he said, would please bring me the price catalogs for all these cameras. That was his first meeting. Anyway, they had many, many. Then in India, when everybody first went to India, these stories, you know, they went to this Amritsar for one Bhagavad Gita convention or something. That's the golden temple of the Sikhs. And they had a lot of, you know, the devotees chanted, everybody really liked it. Different devotees were speaking. Gurdas spoke. So they were all Maya buddies except us, the devotees. So the Gurdas was speaking and he was trying to stress how you have a choice and you want a person and all this. So he gave example. He said, just like you choose to eat nice sweet things, you don't go and eat stool. And they got really upset, all the Maya buddies. And they asked him to stop speaking. And Giriraj spoke a little more carefully. Prabhupada actually said that a few times. He said, you don't eat stool. If it's all one, why don't you eat stool? For the Maya buddies. They could never answer that one. So they all came in to complain to Prabhupada how he spoke like that. So Prabhupada listened to everything and he said, sometimes my American disciples, they use very graphic examples. And then when they all left, Prabhupada said, what was that you said again? And the Prabhupada said, oh, that's good. That's a good one. So when they were leaving, they went going back to Bombay, where they'd been living quite comfortably. The devotees were living at one rich life member's house, and he was taking care of them, whatever they wanted, you know. They would ask for all kinds of opulent nuts and everything. So when they were stopped in Delhi train station, one guy came and he was an Indian lawyer, not a rich, poor guy. And he talked to Prabhupada in Hindi for a long time, and they were thinking maybe he's bothering Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, okay. And then he called Gurdas and he said, This is D.D. Patel, and he wants us to start a temple in Delhi. So get out and see what you can do. Because he was thinking, he was riding with Prabhupada actually, in the privately, and, you know, really in ecstasy. And then Prabhupada said, get out and see what you can do. So he was really shocked. And then Prabhupada said, who do you want to take with you? They said Jamuna, that's his wife, and then he said Giriraj, and then he said another two devotees. Prabhupada said, no, I have plans for them. Then he said Banu was Japanese, and that's another story. Prabhupada, he met him in Japan, and he was not a devotee, he was just visiting the temple. Prabhupada took him to India and told everybody, see, we have Japanese members. And he became a devotee. At one point Prabhupada said, it doesn't seem like Bruce is very interested, so I don't think he'll come back to Japan. But then the next letter said, Bruce is initiated now and he'll be coming back to Japan. That was Pani Maharaj. So they got out, Prabhupada gave him 50 rupees. At that time that was like $7 or $8, so not very much money. And this guy, this Indian guy, was a very, you know, Indian miser. He tried to get them all on his motor scooter. But finally they said, you know, it's not going to work, so he got a taxi. Tried to get them to pay for the taxi, but they wouldn't. But he did have a place for them to stay, some temple, very small rooms. And they started preaching in Delhi. Prabhupada encouraged him. He wrote him, he said, you should make all the politicians and everyone in Delhi, make them all devotees, or make them all life members. And Prabhupada told him different people, he had a lot of friends in Delhi, so they visited these different friends and they happily became life members and got books and invited them for programs. That's how Prabhupada did things, and that wasn't, you know, sometimes there were a lot of surprises. Imagine that, to get out and see what you can do in Delhi, and they'd only been in India for a month or something. Didn't know anybody, no money. But it worked, and he sent it to Vrindavan. And going to build a temple. And they did. He was happy to go to Vrindavan, Gurudas anyway. So these amazing things, how Prabhupada related to everybody, helped everybody, encouraged everybody. I'll just read and we can stop. I told you about the game he played. This is interesting. He went to Nandagram, where Krishna's father lived. One day Prabhupada and I were walking around looking at all the artwork on the walls of the temple there. Prabhupada said, art means full belly. People have to be well fed before they can appreciate the luxury of art. Similarly, we must feed them before they can appreciate the value of Krishna consciousness. They have to be happy. They wanted to make a telex machine in Vrindavan. He said, no, they'll just gossip through the telex. The devotees will just write gossip letters and better don't have them. Wanted to keep them busy. No gossiping. Anything you want, Krishna will give you, but maybe not in the way you want it. Prabhupada was pushing him like anything to finish the temple, that the Vrindavan temple, but they couldn't get it the time he wanted. And Prabhupada then came himself and supervised the construction a lot, pushed everybody like anything. George Harrison and Ravi Shankar came right after the temple opened. George was very happy. He said, Vrindavan is ecstatic. Vrindavan is blissful, he said. And they had a Sri Vatsa Goswami from the Radha Raman was taking him along. And Ravi Shankar said, this is the best temple in Vrindavan. Anyway, Prabhupada said, Krishna will always help you, whatever you want to do. No matter how much difficulty, if you just keep... He said, Krishna doesn't like to see... He was writing that Tejas was distressed because he was all by himself in Delhi. So he said, we have to make first-class new devotees to help more preachers. He said, Krishna does not like to see the devotees unhappy or distressful because of pressure in their service, but if you just preach sincerely, he'll always help you. But be patient. So we have that example about Bhakti Tirthamaraj. He said he wanted to die on the battlefield, so he stayed there in America. But his body cremated for various reasons. Because he don't want to bury the on a public cemetery, and the land in Idanagri is still under the bank, so there's always a chance to lose it. And there's so many laws about burial in America, it's like they wouldn't want to submit the body to all the things that they require. So he's putting a Pushpa Samadhi there in Idanagri, and they're making in October in Mayapur with the ashes samadhi. He planned all this out himself. He thought about it very detailed. He was incredibly a simple person, actually kept everything in perfect order, and Krishna always provided him with lots of servants. It's funny how, see, he grew up in the ghetto and probably didn't have a very nice house or anything. But somehow or other, even in Africa, they built beautiful houses. Not beautiful, but by African standards, they built really nice rooms for the guru. And in America, like the place he had, it blew my mind that you know, they always got a really nice place, and his room was all in a master bedroom, and you know, with a bathroom like bigger than twice bigger than this, jacuzzi and picture windows and everything. Krishna provided him, but we get, and like myself, grew up reasonably opulent, but I always wanted to be poor. I just wanted to live in a tent or out in the jungle or something, you know. I thought this, I don't like this. So I'm always stuck in them. But anyway, he was a great contributor, and it's a loss for all of us, but it's a gain for him, and for Prabhupada has worked in other places. All of us are going to have to leave, so we want to study, you know, remember the examples of the devotees who leave very nicely. Also proves the authentication of our movement and dedicating one's life in ISKCON. We see so many devotees come to the end of their life and leave in very good consciousness and getting help and support from so many other devotees. So we're in the right place. And it's a time to just chant. When I come here, last time I came here, I especially always remembered the beautiful kirtans there. Everybody's a Gandharva, and everybody likes to chant more and more. And Rabindra really liked it here. Kadamba Kanana Maharaj commented to Weimar, oh, that Weimar is so nice. Such a nice group there. So you're very fortunate. And Krishna's arranged, everybody can be together, and somehow your material needs are provided, and the children are lucky that more or less everybody is the same age. That's a big advantage. It's a big advantage. You know, if you get kids that are the only one their age and nobody's even close, then kids have to have friends. So if they can have devotee friends, then that's really good. Maybe you can make a vegetarian kindergarten or something. Vegetarian daycare. And people want that in this country. Well, vegetarian is a big thing. Must be. Biological stores everywhere. Germany is pushing in the right direction in the food department. American government's pushing, you know, genetically modified food. It's something, you know, to shoot for. But German is pushing biological, which is far superior. So I thank you for being here and letting me come. It's been a busy week moving here and there. Munich, and then to Nisringa Cheche, then to Vienna, then back to Nisringa, and back to Berlin, and back here, and back to Berlin. It's an easy country to travel around in. You have good roads, good cars. And after traveling in Africa, then anything seems like a luxury, you know. Even sitting in the house in Africa sometimes, you know, so hot or something, there's no electricity, no fan, no lights, you know, then it gets dark at 6 o'clock, you can't even read, you know. Computer won't last, you know. So it's very luxurious here, even if you have to run around every day. So what now? A little more chanting. Thank you very much. Srila Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj Ki Jai. Srila Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada ISKCON Founder Acharya Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari.